I think it's a step in the right direction.
I do think it is an absolutely terrible idea for our city.
I mean, if it works, it would be great.
Anchorage citizens react to the new vote-by-mail system. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Palmer contemplates expanding its law enforcement beyond city boundaries.
It's not going to be easy or quick, whatever happens.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is preparing an environmental impact statement for the proposed Pebble Mine, and the Walker administration is asking for more time to comment on it. The proposed gold and copper mine would sit upstream from Bristol Bay. Governor Bill Walker has said he doesn't support the mine and believes the priority should be on the region's salmon. The Corps announced a scoping period that would last through the month of April. During those 30 days, the Corps plans to identify the areas and concerns it will focus on in its environmental study. Alaska Natural Resources Commissioner Andy Mack is asking that the scoping period be 3 or 4 months. In a letter to the Alaska Commander of the Corps of Engineers, Mack said a 30-day scoping period isn't adequate for the scale of the project. Mack described it as an open-pit mine a mile across near the headwaters of the most prolific salmon fishery in the world. The Pebble Limited Partnership says it's committed to minimal impact and says its latest design incorporates new environmental safeguards. As Anchorage residents test out the city's first vote-by-mail election, reviews are mixed. The system is not without kinks so far, but as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, the experiment is proceeding steadily toward its April 3rd deadline.
It's been more than 2 years since the Anchorage Assembly approved a measure in 2015 that set the wheels in motion for a mail-in voting system. And since then, the city's clerk's office has steadily tried to raise awareness about the big change in how residents exercise their civic duty. But that doesn't mean that everyone is on the same page about the switch.
I think it's a step in the right direction.
I do think it is an absolutely terrible idea for our city.
I mean, if it works, it would be great. A lot more convenient than having to hunt down where your voting place is.
It makes it easier, but doesn't necessarily mean better. I'm going to miss meeting up with my neighbors. I like going to vote. I always look kind of forward to seeing people that I only see there.
That was Alex Jorgensen, Sterling Emmel, Kim Branson, and Victoria Anderson, all of Anchorage. Ballots were mailed to residents in mid-March, allowing for about 3 weeks before they need to be sent back or dropped off at secure locations. That is, if the mailing address on file was correct. 18,000 ballots were sent back to the clerk's office because of outdated voter information. For Garrison Thoreau, the new system generated a more minor headache.
I'm sure it's convenient for a lot of people, but I actually get my mail out in Eagle River at my parents' house, and I live in Anchorage, so I have to drive out to Eagle River and then drive back to vote.
Security has been a very public concern. 46 ballots were stolen from mailboxes and found in the snow earlier this month in Chugiak. The incident was quickly handled by election officials, but it embodied many residents' worries that a general citywide issue with mail theft could affect election results. But the clerk's office says it has taken many precautions to ensure a secure vote. That includes placing locked drop boxes across town and opening 5 centers spread throughout the municipality to handle ballot issues. Some residents, though, contend that the election shouldn't rely on the mail system. Josiah Nash says that because the return envelopes require a first-class stamp, it amounts to having to pay money just to vote.
I think it really hinders the accessibility of voting. And especially for people who are poor or do not have access to a car, vote by mail, you have to have a mailbox, and you also have to buy stamps.
Nash says the new system may even violate residents' civil rights, a point that, so far, the American Civil Liberties Union in Alaska is not swayed by. Spokesperson for the group says it's monitoring the new election system and has some concerns, but nothing that currently rises to the level of a potential lawsuit. Supporters of Vote by Mail say that it streamlines a lot of the work that goes into running polling stations on Election Day and gives voters more time to learn about the candidates and issues. Cheyenne Matthews says even though she was put off by needing postage to return her ballot, the old way of doing things was far from perfect.
At first I was like, oh, well, that's, you know, an unfortunate system if you have to actually pay to vote. But then I guess the theory behind it is if everyone already in the past had to go to a registered voter station and actually be there, it's really very similar to say you have to go to a registered voter box and just drop it off there.
One of the biggest reasons for switching to vote by mail was to try and increase turnout among registered voters in Anchorage, which can be abysmally low in local elections. In 2013, just 20% of eligible voters cast ballots. As of Wednesday night, the clerk's office had received over 35,000 ballots. That's about 16% of the city's qualified voters, with almost a week remaining until the April 3rd deadline. With help from Victoria Peterson, I'm Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage.
The state is about to go to work responding to Bethel's pothole predicament. The only highway in town is being destroyed by a constant freeze-thaw cycle this winter caused by climate change. Starting today, the Department of Transportation will bring in heavy gear to begin repairing Chief Eddie Hoffman Highway. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports the warm winter has wreaked havoc on highways across Alaska.
They'll start by ripping down into the Bethel Highway's most heavily damaged areas between City Hall and Brown Slough.
What we're going to do is mill it up. We're going to shape it and get it in good shape. It'll be more of a gravel/recycled asphalt product.
Shannon McCarthy is the Department of Transportation spokesperson. She says the road will stay in that condition, with the city grading the product until the entire highway is repaved next summer in 2019. DOT will fill in the rest of the highway potholes with recycled asphalt. Bethel has a small stockpile of the material and has brought it indoors to thaw. The road's destruction happened quickly.
We've been trying to keep up with the potholes, and obviously they're forming faster than we can keep up.
Over the past month, Chief Eddie Hoffman Highway just crumbled into a cratered moonscape. It's the same story all over the state, McCarthy says. The problem is how warm this winter has been. Instead of temperatures dropping below freezing and staying there, they've been fluctuating above and below that point for months.
We didn't used to get freeze thaw, you know, November, December, January, February. And we're getting more of that. And unfortunately, that contributes to that potholing that we get in the spring.
This issue has been escalating for years as winters have grown warmer, forcing the state to spend more money on road maintenance. The DOT is paying for the Bethel repairs with a $70,000 emergency procurement. Even so, the DOT expects more potholes to form once they're done. The roads are still wet, there's plenty more snow to melt, and the freeze-thaw cycle is continuing. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the city of Haines expands one of its prime tourist attractions, the Eagle Aviary.
Not only are we building larger spaces, we're building spaces that are more enriching.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committed to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Thousands of people in the Matanuska Susitna Borough just outside the city limits of Wasilla and Palmer are not covered by city police and rely solely on overworked Alaska State Troopers. As residents of the ever-growing borough grapple for solutions to spiking crime, one idea is expanding city police service to those outer areas. But city officials in Palmer say that would be expensive, difficult, and unlikely to happen anytime soon. About 7,000 people live inside Palmer city limits. It would cost an estimated $3 million annually to provide police service to another 6,500 people in unincorporated areas nearby. That's according to a study compiled by the police department at the city's request. Palmer City Manager Nathan Wallace says the idea has come up at a recent town hall meeting in the area.
It's not going to be easy or quick, whatever happens.
The Palmer City Council took up the issue this week with a brief discussion on the study. Wallace says they found that an expansion would likely require the annexation of outlying areas or a contract with the borough to pay for more police officers. He says either idea might be unpopular and increase property taxes.
It's not something that we would just go out and say, okay, we're going to provide some police services. Thank you very much. It's something that has to start really at the citizens' level that live outside the cities.
The talks in Palmer are just one part of a broader discussion on crime and policing in the surrounding Mat-Su borough. A recent study by the University of Alaska Anchorage Justice Center shows staffing of Alaska State Troopers in the region is one trooper per 2,000 residents, less than a third of the national average. In a letter to the state legislature and governor this week, Borough Mayor Vern Halter describes the situation in one subdivision just outside Wasilla as a public safety emergency. Halter says the state needs to fund more trooper positions in the borough. A new life-saving service has just been added to some medevac aircraft in southeast Alaska. Airlift Northwest is now offering blood transfusions on two planes stationed in Juneau. KSTK's June Leffler has more.
Airlift Northwest has performed more than 200 mid-air blood transfusions in the Pacific Northwest. But just last week, the nonprofit service did its first in Alaska. The patient was at Juneau's Bartlett Regional Hospital. Chris Martin is the executive director of Airlift Northwest.
I mean, we've had patients that we really don't think would have survived had we not had blood on our aircraft. So for us and for a lot of patients, it's been life-changing.
Their aircraft only carried regular IV fluid before. Now each aircraft carries 2 units of O-negative blood, the universal blood type, and 2 units of plasma.
You give somebody just regular fluids, it doesn't have the oxygen carrying capacity like blood does, like blood and plasma do. Plus it doesn't have anything in it to help the body clot, which blood and plasma have. So it's all about clotting and it's all about oxygenation.
She says military trauma medicine has encouraged this change in practice. Other medevac operators in Alaska, such as LifeMed, also perform transfusions. But they don't carry their own blood on the planes at all times. Instead, they pick up the blood from the hospital every time a patient would require it. Airlift's blood and plasma are transported from Seattle to Juneau and exchanged twice a week. Airlift partnered with Alaska Airlines to do this. If the blood is not used in a few days, it is sent back to Seattle to Harborview Hospital's trauma center, where someone is likely to need it. Brenda Nelson is Airlift's chief flight nurse.
And what that does is not allow the blood to go to waste. So it gets put back into the system to be used by the hospital at Harborview at the trauma center.
Martin says Airlift will spend $35,000 a year to transport those fluids. Airlift is affiliated with the University of Washington's medical program, which also operates Seattle's Harborview Medical Center. In Wrangell, I'm June Leffler.
Alaska's naturopathic doctors are seeking to expand their authority to treat patients. That's despite a legal setback and mixed testimony from the medical profession. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
Naturopathy is a form of alternative medicine. It can be controversial. Critics say it mixes pseudoscience and folk remedies with evidence-based medicine. It's banned in 2 states. Supporters counter that it makes use of traditional healing but doesn't discount modern science. More than a dozen states grant licensed naturopaths limited rights to prescribe medication. That allows them to treat many ailments normally handled by medical doctors. Alaska isn't one of those states. A licensed naturopath in Alaska can swab a patient's sore throat for strep bacteria, but can't prescribe the antibiotics to treat it. Nor can they stitch a wound. That effectively gives them less medical authority than nurse practitioners or physician's assistants. The Alaska Association of Naturopathic Physicians sued to overturn these restrictions. The case went all the way to the Alaska Supreme Court, which earlier this month upheld the rules. Abby Lang is president of the Alaska's Naturopaths Association. She says she's one of about 50 practicing naturopaths in the state.
The recent court case was our trying to kind of claw back a small scope of practice that we had that changed in 2014 due to interpretations by regulations. And we respect this ruling, of course, but it still allows for a substantial gap to remain between what naturopaths are trained to do and what we're allowed to do.
House Bill 326 and Senate Bill 120 would effectively overturn the court ruling. More than 60 patients wrote letters of support, people like Jody Oakes. She told lawmakers she suffered from chronic headaches last summer, but she decided not to take the medication prescribed by her doctor and instead sought out alternative treatment.
I have been migraine-free since October 2017, and I attribute this to the medical treatment I received from our naturopathic doctor.
Medical doctors have weighed in on both sides.
I've seen patients that they've treated, and I think within their realm, they do a good job.
Fairbanks physician Peter Lorison chairs the Alaska State Medical Association, which opposes the bill. He said he's skeptical naturopaths get enough training to prescribe drugs.
They have the 4 years after college, and that's fine, but this is apparently rather variable from institution to institution, state to state, and that would bring us to the equivalent of just finishing medical school.
Other medical doctors testified in favor of the bill and the profession.
I've had the opportunity of working with a number of naturopaths over the course of my career in Alaska, and I have always felt that they were well-trained in what they do.
Alan Gross is a medical doctor and advocate for making healthcare more affordable.
This bill improves both access and competition, which I believe will lower the cost of care. Healthcare costs are the biggest problem facing the state of Alaska today.
The House bill sponsor is Anchorage Democrat Garen Tarr. The Senate's companion bill was filed last year by Anchorage Republican Kathy Geisel, but has yet to be heard. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
A resident of a remote southeast Alaska island has been arrested on charges of shooting at a fishing vessel. Alaska State Troopers say 60-year-old Donald Austin of Wadley Island was jailed in Craig. Troopers at about 5 a.m. on Tuesday received a report of a man shooting at a boat fishing for herring west of Klawock on Prince of Wales Island. Investigators determined Austin fired multiple rounds, causing crew members to fear for their lives. At least one bullet struck the boat. Austin was charged with felony assault and weapons misconduct. Troopers say alcohol was a factor in the shooting.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
UA is working to build Alaska's future workforce with investment in UA-educated teachers. Individuals interested in a future in teaching can apply for the President's Teach for Alaska Scholarship for degree studies at any of the UA campuses. An education from the University of Alaska is an investment for the future. Application period closes May 1st. More at alaska.edu/learn-to-teach. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station.
Army officials have begun the years-long process of decommissioning Alaska's first and only nuclear power plant located at Fort Greeley. The facility was built during the height of the Cold War, then shut down in 1972 after 10 years of on-and-off operation. Much of it was dismantled and disposed of, the rest encased in concrete. Now, the Army Corps of Engineers plans to remove most or perhaps all of what's left. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The Army built Fort Greeley's nuclear power plant, called the SM-1A, as part of an experimental program to determine if such facilities could be operated in remote sites more cheaply than diesel-fueled power plants.
The main approach was to reduce significant fuel transportation costs by having a nuclear reactor that could operate for long terms with just one nuclear core.
Brian Hardy manages the Army Corps of Engineers' deactivated nuclear power plant program. He says the Army built the SM-1A in 1962 and hopes the facilities could provide power reliably to remote radar facilities around the Arctic that would scan the skies for incoming missiles from the Soviet Union, which at the time was America's arch rival.
Because of the Cold War, The Air Force and Army were looking at the potential for a lot of the defense radar sites to be located up there.
Hardy says the program worked, but maybe not in the way the Pentagon officials had hoped. They learned the SM-1A could be built and operated in a cold and remote locale, but they discovered its upfront costs were much higher than anticipated and that it cost more to maintain than a diesel power plant. And he says before long, the program was no longer relevant because of the Soviets' advances in rocket science.
One of the big things that shut down the program overall was the creation of the ICBMs that would go up over the defense early warning systems. And so it kind of made those obsolete.
So the SM-1A, built at a cost of about $17 million, was shut down in 1972 after 8 years of operation. It was out of commission from 1967 to 69 for extensive repairs. Hardy says the plant was partially dismantled soon after it was deactivated.
All of the fuel in the reactor core was removed and shipped back to the Atomic Energy Commission for them to either reprocess or dispose of. The highly activated control and absorber rods were also removed and shipped back to the AEC.
The power plant produced 1.8 megawatts of electricity and 20 megawatts of thermal energy, including steam, which was used to heat the post. That part of the system was still needed, so Army officials removed most of the nuclear power system and hooked the heat and steam components to a diesel-fired boiler. But they left several parts of the nuclear system in place, including the highly radioactive reactor pressure vessel and reactor coolant pumps.
Those were either kept in place or they were cut off and laid down in the bottom of the tall vapor containment building there, and then they were grouted and concreted in place.
That is what remains to be cleaned up, along with other remediation, in order for the SM-1A to be declared fully decommissioned. Hardy says the Corps of Engineers wants to remove all the stuff, but he says it's not yet known whether that's feasible. Meanwhile, he says monitoring for radioactivity around the facility shows it remains at acceptably low levels.
It would be safe to say there's no threat to the human health and the environment.
Brenda Barber is project manager for the decommissioning. She says it's still in its early stages and won't be completed until 2026 at the earliest. She says the Corps awarded a $4.6 million contract in December to a Virginia-based firm to develop a long-range plan for the project. Among other things, that'll help agency officials determine how much of the SM-1A will remain after it's decommissioned.
There will still be buildings there. There will still be components of some of the old structure there that may likely remain.
Barber says she and other officials working on the project visited the site in January. She says she and Hardy will be back in April to again meet with post officials, as well as members of a local community advisory board. And she says that's when planning will begin in earnest for the final disposition of Alaska's one and only nuclear power plant. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
The American Bald Eagle Foundation Raptor Center and Natural History Museum in Haines is building a new aviary. The Raptor Center houses three bald eagles and is a tourism attraction for the Southeast Alaska town. From KHNS, Dacia Eaton has more.
These are Arden and Vega. They are two bald eagles here. We have three bald eagles.
That's Stephanie Jenkinson, the Raptor Program Manager at the center. She's in charge of the food, the husbandry, and enrichment for the birds that live at the center.
These two eagles are resident eagles, and their job is to educate people. So they both work for a living, and what you're about to witness is one of the training sessions.
Against a painted backdrop of an Alaska mountain scene and through wire mesh, two bald eagles do their daily training, hopping from their perches up high onto platforms down below, where handlers reward them with morsels of moose meat. That's Vega, the oldest bald eagle at the center. She's in her mid-20s. Eagles can live a long time into their 40s. Vega is one of the reasons why they're overhauling the aviary. We'll get back to that later. Eagles and their handlers are practicing their routine for cruise ship season in Haines, which brings thousands of people to see them. The Raptor Center is at the heart of tourism here, and their building is right in the middle of town, between the post office and the police station. Passengers from cruise ships line up each summer to see the eagles and other raptors up close. The center's mission is the conservation of the bald eagle and its habitat. One of the largest congregations of eagles in the world takes place about 20 miles from here each fall along the banks of the Chilkat River, where the birds come to feast on spawned-out salmon. The Raptor Center opened in 2010, but the existing spaces where the largest birds live are less than ideal, says Sydney Campbell, the education and development manager at the center.
Our three bald eagles really shouldn't be housed together, but we only have the space now to allow us to keep one separate and two who are housed together.
These birds of prey normally have large territories, and they're opportunistic feeders. Housing the eagles together can cause problems, says Campbell. Remember Vega from earlier?
Our largest bald eagle, Vega, is older and wiser and definitely larger than the other two, and she's much better at competing. And because bald eagles are scavengers and they like to steal food, she's really good at stealing it from the other two.
Having three separate rooms for the eagles is part of the plan for the new aviary. Plus, it also includes a weathering yard where birds can perch, sun themselves, and where outdoor training can take place, as well as a walking path so guests can connect with the birds in a closer setting.
We want them to be able to do their job to the best of their abilities. So not only are we building larger spaces, we're building spaces that are more enriching. We're demolishing a building that's currently blocking a lot of light to some of the existing aviaries. And so this way, rather than having the birds kind of staring at each other all day, we'll have them looking around at their surroundings. They'll be able to see the wildlife that's nearby. There's lots of bird watching, lots of squirrel watching that's really enriching.
The idea is to give the eagles more room and some of the stimulation they would have in a wild setting, and to give visitors a better experience, says Campbell.
Currently, we can't open the aviaries to the public. We lead a tour through there every day in the summer, but that's capped at 15 people. So very few of our guests actually get to see all of the birds because some of them don't come out and do glove work.
Besides the bald eagles, the Raptor Center is also home to two red-tailed hawks, a Eurasian eagle owl, an eastern screech owl, a peregrine falcon, a Lanner-Saker hybrid falcon, and a merlin.
So by building the two new structures and by tearing out the old existing structure, we're going to open it up and people can kind of go on their own self-guided tours.
After the new aviary is complete, Campbell says hopefully the eagles and the people who come to see them will have a much more authentic experience at the Raptor Center. The center has raised more than $50,000 for the new aviary through a GoFundMe page, but they need to raise more to reach their goal. The groundwork for the project is scheduled to take place in April, and construction is scheduled to be completed this fall. In Haines, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zachariah Hughes and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, June Leffler in Wrangell, Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Daisha Eaton in Haines. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating more than 40 years of Alaska operations. Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
If you love a good mystery, Thursday nights on Alaska Public Media TV is the place for you. Join us every week as we search for clues, put the pieces together, and figure out who done it. Mystery Thursdays only on Alaska Public Media TV. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.